Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, it's the energy news, with stories and analysis by yours truly, Bruce Dixon, David Rovics, and even the New York Times. I hope you'll stay tuned. This started out as one of our odds and ends shows. And, as usually happens, the odds and ends cluttering the closet shelves of my mind turned out not to be random after all, but, in fact, pretty closely connected. This would come as a surprise to me, except I've gotten used to it at last. Just one of those quirks of my mind. Randomness keeps slipping away when I try to grasp it. So our show this week has a theme after all, and that theme is energy news. The biggest energy news since the Gulf oil disaster is Shell Oil's announcement that it is giving up its project to drill for oil in the Arctic off Alaska. That announcement came the end of September, and Greenpeace immediately claimed victory. I hate to be a party pooper, but I personally don't see any victory here. New Englanders may recognize the Arctic drilling news as very similar to the Vermont Yankee news. Vermont Yankee is a decrepit nuclear power plant that has been menacing the health and safety of New Englanders for decades. It's just upstream from here, near Burlington, Vermont. It's falling apart. Its pipes are weak and corroded. It's had accidents aplenty in recent years. And its corporate owner was determined to milk every possible penny of profit out of the plant. For years, environmentalists had been trying and failing to get the thing shut down. Even the Vermont legislature tried and failed to get the thing shut down. The public be damned, said the plant's owner, Entergy Corp. Then, about a year ago, Entergy Corp itself decided to shut the plant down. It did so for the only reason that really matters in corporate America. The plant wasn't making enough profit. Strictly a business decision. And now Shell Oil has shut down an even bigger menace for much the same reason. Here's the story from the New York Times. Shell exits Arctic as slump in oil prices forces industry to retrench. Dated September 28, 2015. As oil prices have continued their steady decline this year, rig after rig has been shut down, costing thousands of jobs in the United States. Yet, major oil producers have been loath to pull the plug on their most ambitious projects. Until now. On Monday, Royal Dutch Shell ended its expensive and fruitless 9-year effort to explore for oil in the Alaskan Arctic. A $7 billion investment. This is another sign that the industry is trimming its ambitions in the wake of collapsing oil prices. Shell's announcement was hailed as a major victory by environmentalists who had fought the project for years. But at the moment, global markets are gutted with oil thanks to new drilling techniques. The industry has cut its investment by 20% this year, and laid off at least 200,000 workers worldwide. Companies also have retreated from less profitable fields in the North Sea, West Africa, Louisiana, and North Dakota. American oil companies have decommissioned more than half of their drilling rigs over the past year, and production is beginning to drop in the United States. Even exports from Saudi Arabia are beginning to decline because of a glut in its Asian markets. The price of oil has fallen more than 50% since last summer and is now below $50 a barrel. With demand dwindling, the current market of 94 million barrels a day has roughly 2 million barrels in surplus supply. The proposed Iran nuclear deal could lower oil prices further when more Iranian oil enters the world markets. Sidebar comment, so now you see another reason for the huge opposition in Congress to settling our differences with Iran peacefully. If we stop pretending Iran is the arch enemy and we lift our economic embargo, then more Iranian oil will be available. The price of oil will go down further, and the profits of the big campaign contributors our legislators were born to serve, specifically the profits of the big oil companies, may well decline a little. Conflict in the Middle East is good for McDonnell Douglas, but it's even better for ExxonMobil. So let's not hear any more loose talk about negotiation and treaties. Back to the text. The article continues. With Arctic drilling, economic forces have now scuttled what environmentalists had tried and failed to do for years. Quote, "This is a victory for everyone who has stood up for the Arctic," said Annie Leonard, executive director of Greenpeace. Continuing the quote, "There is no better time to keep fossil fuels in the ground, bringing us one step closer to an energy revolution and sustainable future." Unquote. ConocoPhillips and the Norwegian oil giant Statoil had earlier suspended their Alaska offshore drilling operations. Shell's $7 billion Arctic drilling project has been plagued by blunders and accidents involving ships and support equipment, reaching a climax in the grounding of one of its drilling vessels in December 2012. Shell also announced that the one Arctic well it had drilled this summer was not rich enough in oil and gas to warrant the high cost of further exploration. So ends the New York Times account by reporters Clifford Krause and Stanley Reed. I have edited and condensed the article a bit for radio. Hey, in the Times article, did you catch the name of Greenpeace's new head? Annie Leonard. Yes, it's Annie Leonard, the filmmaker. In years past, we've played the soundtrack from a few of her short films, including The Story of Stuff and The Story of Bottled Water. Well, good luck in your new job, Annie, and more power to you. But I have to disagree with your victory speech. "This is a victory for everyone who has stood up for the Arctic," said Annie Leonard. Well, to my jaundiced eye, not really. It looks more like another victory for capitalism and market forces. And when oil prices get above $150 a barrel again, I think we'll be gazing off the Atlantic coast and saying, "They're back." Mock my words. As my father used to say in his Boston accent, mock my words. But enough about me. There's more good energy news, and the good folks at Black Agenda Report had a nice take on it. Commentator Bruce Dixon notes that we should be grateful for a recent energy and environmental decision made by President Obama. But, he says, let's not forget that, overall, Obama's record on the environment has been very, very bad. Here's Bruce Dixon.
President Obama announced his plan last week to slash U.S. carbon emissions by 2030, mostly via EPA rules, which will effectively prohibit new coal-fired electric plants. This is unambiguously good news, especially from a president who once declared himself in favor of clean coal. The bad news is that the Obama administration could have done this in its first weeks in office, rather than half past its seventh year, and it does not begin to redeem Obama's climate change legacy. The bad news is that the U.S. still leads the world in water-polluting, earthquake-causing fracking, in taxpayer subsidies to the fracking industry, and in the export of fracking technologies, for which the Obama administration has been a tireless advocate. The bad news is that when the Deepwater Horizon disaster, the largest known gas and oil spill in history, occurred in 2010, the Obama administration actively colluded with oil companies to lie to the public, concealing the volume and the extent of the leak. President Obama had the U.S. Navy and Coast Guard ban civilian overflights of the spill area, and local police agencies bar civilian access to affected shorelines, apparently to prevent independent experts from assessing the extent of damage and the speed of which the poisonous discharge was settling to the seafloor. The Obama Justice Department even protected British Petroleum by declaring that the damage awards could only be assessed against BP's holding in the U.S. Gulf, rather than against its global assets on six continents and oceans across the planet. But although the president's party controlled both houses of Congress for another 6 months, President Obama and his party sponsored not one piece of legislation, not one administrative rule to rein in the plundering activities of big oil. The bad news is that despite past disasters and future dangers, the Obama administration continues to issue new permits for drilling up and down the Atlantic and Gulf coasts, and is even permitting deep water offshore fracking. What could possibly go wrong? The bad news is that the Obama administration, just like the Bush and Clinton ones before it, has continued the bipartisan American tradition of subverting and destroying international accords on climate change, giving the final coup de grace to the Kyoto Accords, and condemning hundreds of millions in Asia, Africa, and Oceania to suffer the ravages of climate change. The bad news is that the Obama administration's equivocation on the Keystone Pipeline seems transparently calculated to get his party through the 2016 election, after which it will almost certainly be approved whoever is elected. The Obama administration has even issued permits for drilling in the Arctic Ocean, accessible for the first time in hundreds of thousands of years due to the melting of polar ice caps. Actual leadership on climate change would set a near-term goal of 80% to 90% of U.S. energy needs to be met by renewables like wind and solar, an end to fracking on land and sea, and the banning of offshore drilling, especially in the Arctic. Climate change leadership would be applauding the citizen activists who are delaying the departure of Shell's mammoth Arctic drilling rig from the port of Seattle. Climate change leadership would have the U.S. look more like Germany, which, although it's as far north as Canada, derives most of its energy from wind and solar power and other renewables. At this point, climate change leadership would mean popularizing the case for leaving the coal in the hole, the gas beneath the grass, and the oil in the soil, while we fund and find other ways to power our agriculture, our cities, and our lives. But none of that is part of the Obama legacy on climate change, which is pretty words, but ugly actions. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon.
Ah, Barack Obama. Remember him? As you may have noticed, campaigning for the 2016 elections is already underway, hot and heavy. Remember the 2008 election campaign? Remember what a joy it was to vote for Barack H. Obama? Or at least it was a joy to many progressive people I know. This was a joy I did not share. But the 2008 election followed 8 long years of George W. Bush and his blatant, unapologetic, and successful assault on practically everything you valued: democracy, peace, civil liberties, government of law, the Bill of Rights, even the English language, to say nothing of geography. He referred to Africa as a country, and he said that the national language of Mexico was Mexican. Let's not forget his indefensible destruction of Iraq, based on transparent lies that kept changing every couple of weeks. Then, on a white horse, comes Barack Obama out of nowhere. I mean, in 2006, had you even heard of this guy? 2 years later, he's elected president. In the campaign, he promises to make the American government good and decent again. He will restore the rule of law, end government wiretapping of its citizens. He will enact real health care reforms, and the centerpiece of the reform will be the option for single payer open to every citizen. He will prosecute corporate criminals who crashed the world economy, and he will provide relief to the millions of Americans who lost their homes and their jobs in the crash. And his first official act as president will be to close the obscene prison and torture chamber at Guantanamo Bay, island of Cuba. So he promised. I think that, at heart, the American people really are a good and decent people. And after 8 years of Bush, we yearned for what Obama was promising. We wanted our government to act morally and certainly legally. We yearned for decency and democracy. We yearned for an end to the needless wars that Bush had started. And we voted for Obama overwhelmingly. Americans in general did, I mean. We ignored the many red flags, the many warning signs that this story was too good to be true. In November 2008, despite still more Republican vote rigging, Obama won decisive popular and electoral majorities. Not only that, but his political party, the Democrats, won large majorities in both the House and the Senate, which they held on to for 2 years. With a huge popular mandate and control of both houses of Congress, Obama devoted his first 2 years in office to doing what? To seeing that Wall Street banks got reimbursed by the taxpayer every penny that they lost through destroying the world economy. And incidentally, the working class and the middle class and the poor got practically nothing. Also, Obama immediately put the brakes on health care reform, making very sure that single payer would not be an option. He expanded spying on citizens and refused to prosecute the corporations for illegally conniving in it. He increased U.S. military violence abroad. He said that his first official act would be to close the prison at Guantanamo. Well, 7.5 years later, the prison is still in business. Do you believe that the commander-in-chief of the armed forces does not have the power to close one military prison? Are you disillusioned yet? In 2009 and 2010, it was sad seeing many of my liberal friends profess their continuing belief that Obama was really a progressive liberal. Just give him time to get organized, they said. Then our liberal savior will emerge, you'll see. 2010, they said. Oh, Obama is just biding his time. Wait until after the midterm elections. 2011, they said. Look, Obama really is on our side, but the Republicans are just stopping him from acting like his true self. It was a sad sight. So many progressive people insisting that Obama really was a liberal, insisting that Like Clark Kent, any day now, Obama would strip off the costume and reveal his true liberal self. Insisting on this, despite all the evidence to the contrary. It's sad to see a dream slowly disappear. And it was sad to see so many of my friends very reluctantly give up their hopes and dreams at long last. And they were good hopes and dreams, too, worthy ones. I don't feel at all good about being proved right about Obama. I'm as broken-hearted as anyone. Not disillusioned, as I never shared the illusion, but broken-hearted anyway. At least these days, so far as I can tell, nobody has any illusions about President Hillary Clinton or President Jeb Bush, as the case may be. Jeb Bush. Does anyone even know his real first name? What's Jeb Bush's real name? Does anybody even know that? Come on, it can't be any worse than Obama's middle name, and we knew what that was before the election. What's Jeb Bush's actual name? No, it's not Loretta. I will tell you. His name is John Ellis Bush. Remember, you heard it here first. But I digress. Okay, no more looking to politicians for salvation. How about some more good news? If salvation is to be had, it won't come from the politicians, but possibly from the people. Here's an upbeat contribution from David Rovics. It's about energy and about what the people can accomplish to make the world better. In Denmark in the 1970s, in the Jutland Peninsula off the North Atlantic, some more or less everyday people stopped an attempt to build a nuclear power plant, designed and built the biggest wind power turbine in the world, and gave the patent rights to the public domain. Here's the story.
At the same time as they were going nuts building highways around the U.S. and to a somewhat lesser extent all over Europe and elsewhere in the 60s and 70s and 80s, they were also building nuclear reactors all over the place. All the countries that could afford to were doing it, pretty much. Denmark being an exception, and the exception was the cause of a mass movement. Just like the highway here. It was in the 1970s. The fuel crisis had begun. The choices were presented to us, as if we had none. Leaders of industry say that they could solve the problem by mastering the power of the radioactive atom. Some folks in Western Jutland got a notion in their heads. They thought there might be something they could offer up instead. A few hundred people gathered at a little place called Tvind and declared their will to harness the power of the wind. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. Some of them were scientists, the vast majority were not. But they knew with years of effort, you could do a lot. Word about the project spread far and wide. 100,000 visitors came to help and to advise. Until one day these windmill builders drove in with a crane and lifted up their giant wings with a mighty chain. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. When Tvind Kraft was completed, it reached up to the sky. Its wings churned in the air at 54 meters high. The critics all fell silent. No one now was jeering, as even industry agreed. This was some damn fine engineering. Wind regaled Jutland from the North Atlantic Sea, as it was seamlessly converted into electricity. It was power for the people, leukemia for none, when they declared in Denmark, just south of the midnight sun, we're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill. They gave away the patents. They said knowledge should be free. And their plans were copied by a newborn industry. Soon Denmark would be known as a windmill building nation. And it all started with some hippies at the Tvindkraft power station. Debates were held in parliament about which way things should go. Build a nuclear reactor, the majority said no. It could have gone quite differently in much of the world it did, except for those in Ulfborg who said we're getting off the grid. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill in the world. We're gonna build the biggest windmill.
Ending our energy show on an upbeat note, that was David Rovics. He sang at a rally in Boston in January 2013. That very good live recording was made by Boston's invaluable Chuck Rosina. Thank you again, Chuck. And thank you, Loretta, or whatever your name might be, for listening to New World Notes. On the web, you'll find an archive of almost all our past shows, plus links, pretty pictures, and whatnot, at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, wishing you the best, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll come back again next week. Ciao.